Hi, I'm Anthony DeMarzay, and this is my podcast project, Lights, Cities and Architecture. This podcast is a way of learning and a way to advocate for sustainability. You don't have to be an architect or a designer to play a role in sustainability. I think we all know that. And this episode, we discuss how office furniture forms part of the built environment. Our guest today is Andrew Egan, and Andrew is the founder and director of Egan's Asset Management, who specialise in the removal, storage and upcycling of commercial workstations and office furniture. Following a career as a market trader and auctioneer in London and Sydney, Andrew founded Egan's Asset Management and Wise Office Furniture Program in 1996. Andrew's personal values and passion for sustainability will be very clear when we talk to him today, and it led to the creation of a circular economy model that achieves landfill avoidance. For people with a passion for sustainability, there's never been a better moment to be alive. And that was Andrew Egan a couple of months ago when we talked about doing this podcast together. So welcome, Andrew, to Lights, Cities and Architecture. You want to give the listeners a bit of an insight into who you are and your journey?
I'd be happy to do that. My name's Andrew Egan. I probably started the journey that we're going to talk about in London in the 80s. I was a trader on market stalls. I had a permanent stall in Camden Town on a Saturday and Sunday, and I was an itinerant market trader at Covent Garden on a Monday and did Portobello Road or Brick Lane on Thursdays and Fridays. And it kind of got me into this world of, you know, to make a living out of buying and selling, essentially.
Okay.
One thing led to another. I ended up in Sydney in the late 80s and got a job in an auction house, which really intrigued me.
So auction houses meaning buying and selling furniture?
Yeah, chattels auctioneers. So we were kind of household furniture auctions once a week.
They were a big thing in the 80s, is what I recall.
They were a big thing. You know, B-grade art auctions and antique auctions and some Persian carpet auctions on Sundays.
Bridge Road in Richmond, I recall, was a big place for auctions.
That's right.
Antiques and perhaps not high quality, necessarily high quality antiques, but certainly a lot of stuff was being bought and sold by traders, is what I understood.
We were more on a commercial level. So, yes, we did the antiques and the B-grade art and that sort of stuff on a Sunday.
Mm-hmm.
But we were more the household clearance house. And at the time, an emerging section of the auction house that I worked in was the commercial furniture section, which is really where my journey in commercial furniture started. I saw this commercial furniture coming in alongside the household furniture, and I decided to split the two up and develop the whole line of commercial furniture auctions.
Now, at one point, you made a decision, obviously, to move to Melbourne for love, I assume, for you married your partner and you moved to Melbourne, and then you started Egan's Office Management, Asset Management, sorry.
Yeah, so in Sydney, being an auctioneer of commercial furniture, I used to procure the furniture from the removal companies. So they were the big removal companies were doing these large-scale moves around Sydney. They might be moving the Commonwealth Bank or the government department, and we would be the auctioneer. We would be the delivery point for the furniture, and then we'd sell the furniture. So I came to Melbourne in the mid-90s, had seen both sides of the people removing it in and us being the sellers. And so I put the two together and took that out to the market as a proposition. I'll execute your move. I'll take you from Collins Street to Bourke Street, and then I'll take away whatever you don't want, and we'll truck that to a warehouse that then was in Burwood. And we'll sell it on your behalf and give you a check at the end of it. And typically, the value of the auction was greater than the cost of the move.
So that was the sort of the business model.
That was the beginning of the journey. Fast forward 30 years later, and here we are. Same category of assets, same buildings.
So I guess the listeners might be wondering, why have I got Andrew on podcast? And I think I'll make a few observations. Firstly, I've been really intrigued by your journey. We've sort of known each other for quite a while. You're actually working close to where I worked, and I saw the beginnings of your company in South Melbourne. And what I've been struck by is just the innovation that you've brought to this area of expertise. So we're talking about office furniture. So let's talk about, I don't know, a 200 square meter office floor space, or, you know, 150 square meter space somewhere in the city. It's full of desks. It's full of workstations. It's stools, plants, office, you know, monitors, staplers, all sorts of things that go into that space. We often don't really think about that as a resource. In architecture and interior design, it's referred to as FF&E. I know you have a different name for it, FF&E, meaning furniture, fittings and equipment. But what I've observed with what you're doing is you actually see that furniture, fittings and equipment as an asset class that needs to be thought about. And in a way, the life of that furniture and fittings and equipment, you know, it has to go beyond the sort of typical 7 or 8 years that it takes for, you know, an office interior to be transformed. Have I sort of roughly got that right?
Yeah, I think that just to give it some scale, a standard city building has a floor plate which is about between 1,000 and 1,500 mm-hmm. square metres. It might have between 90 and 130 occupants per level.
Mm-hmm.
What those occupants are sitting at is materially changed mm-hmm. since we started doing it. And I mean, I referred earlier to the Commonwealth Bank moving out of Martin Place in Sydney, and they were freestanding desks with a timber side and a timber top, you know. That's very different to what came in the 90s, which was a systems furniture desk with a screen that you plug your computer into.
Mm-hmm. So we're talking 1990s.
So during the 1990s, it became systems furniture, which is what most people would understand. Most architects would be designing workstations into those buildings. And most people that go and work in them will be sitting at a workstation next to somebody else at the same workstation. And then you've got the commercial grade chair, which is important because it needs to be ergonomic. Back in the day, you used to have a lot of storage. You have less and less of that now.
Mm-hmm.
So the composition of the office has changed quite a lot. But essentially, it's where 90 to 130 people go and sit down and work every day at a computer.
Just take us, I mean, I know you've taken us through that sort of journey, but, you know, just think about the impact of technology and how has that transformed the office environment in the, say, let's call it the 30 years that you've been in this game? How have you seen that evolve and change? And perhaps even reflecting a little bit on what's happened with COVID and how we actually moved away from the office and went home. And then, you know, there's this sort of desire to get back into the city. Can you just sort of map out in a sort of broad scale the transformation that's occurred in work in that time?
I think I'd like to frame that up in economies. Mm-hmm. I'd like to say that at the beginning in the 90s, in the 80s and 90s, we were in the linear economy. And I'll explain a bit about that shortly. Through the 90s, that changed and we went into the recycle economy, and that those economies follow the fashion of furniture. And now we're in the circular economy or moving towards that. So in the linear economy, everything was freestanding. There was not necessarily, or there had recently not been a need to plug anything in. The only reason we transferred to workstations, which had a spine screen, is so you could plug things in. Cable reticulation was what they were built for. And then the idea came that if you built a screen down the middle, you could attach the desk to the screen. Mm-hmm. So the desk became no longer freestanding. The linear economy was really valid when you could pick a desk up and sell it.
Mm-hmm.
That's what I did as an auctioneer. Wheel a chair in and sell it. You'd have a filing cabinet that would be useful in a home. Bookcases the same. So at the time that we were selling in the linear economy through the 90s, I was one of 5 auction houses in Sydney. There were 5 in Melbourne, 2 in Brisbane, 2 in Adelaide. And we all sold 1,000 pieces of furniture a week.
Mm-hmm.
And we sold it to a second-hand market that was vibrant,
mm-hmm.
that could pull their trucks up and load things in an orderly fashion into their trucks. And in Sydney, they'd take them to Wollongong and Newcastle and Dubbo. And in Melbourne, they take them to Ballarat and Bendigo and Geelong.
For reuse, I assume.
For resale.
So they might end up in someone's home office or an office in a small office tenancy, a real estate agency or something like that.
That's right, because it was fully transferable as standalone furniture.
Mm-hmm.
But then as the furniture became more systems furniture and more workstation style, you couldn't obviously pick that desk up and reuse it in a regional office or in fact in a home. And that also coincided with the arrival of businesses like Officeworks,
mm-hmm.
who would sell your domestic chair for your son or your daughter to sit on as a study chair for probably less than you could buy a very good quality second-hand office chair out of the mm-hmm. city. So I guess what we're describing here is the breakdown of the linear economy taking care of the problem.
Mm-hmm.
It was transferring it from B to C, and it would sit in your daughter's bedroom for the 10 years that she was there studying, and then it would probably be there for 10 years after that.
Mm-hmm.
So you've got 25 years worth of life out of that desk and that chair. When that stopped happening, it broke down the marketplace.
So when we're talking about, essentially talking about a cheaper, I mean, it's a very well-designed system for the purpose that it was intended to function for, but at the end of that life, the ability to reuse or recycle that workstation or that office chair wasn't there, is what I'm hearing.
The ability to reuse it wasn't there, and so what emerged was the need to recycle it. One thing that I think is worth highlighting here is that at no point in the journey in commercial furniture in Australia, in all the cities, it has always been really good quality material.
Mm-hmm.
There is no second grade material in the buildings in Sydney, Melbourne and Adelaide, and there never has been.
In terms of office furniture?
In terms of office furniture. It's more the form that's been the problem. It's more the way it's presented and the way it can be reused. From a material level, it's always been first rate.
And what do you attribute that to? Is it being the local manufacturers, or because I assume a lot of this stuff is coming from overseas, is it generally that we have actually placed value on office furniture and equipment?
And I think it comes down to the ergonomics for the user and the fact that the employer has an obligation to provide a safe workplace that doesn't send you home injured, and so there's consideration given.
Well, that's good to know.
When the linear economy stopped doing its job, it became for us a challenge of, we can only sell 800 pieces of 1,000 pieces of furniture. What do we do with the 200 pieces?
If I'm understanding this correctly, that became your challenge. How do we avoid this office chair, this workstation, this coffee table, whatever it is, ending up in landfill? And why did that become a personal interest to you? Is it you saw some moral or ethical requirement for doing that? Did you see a business opportunity? What was the sort of thinking that went into that?
I think probably all three of those are moral, ethical, and it was definitely an opportunity. You know, the market as it existed was turning away from the product, and there was nothing wrong with the product. So we just started to break it down.
And breaking it down meaning that you were looking to recycle the raw materials. I remember when I talked to you, it would have been about 5 or 6 years ago, you used the term that you thought of the city as a big mining site, that essentially that there were all these materials there, steel, aluminium, glass, material, wood, timber, and that essentially that was a resource that could be on-sold in different formats and would contribute to diverting that material to landfill, but was also an economic opportunity for you.
Yeah, that's right. So as that secondhand market closed down and it became less competitive, our clients had to think about what they were going to do with it. So they were encouraged to pay us to break it apart, to exactly as you said, to extract the aluminium and the steel and the various recyclable material for what was then considered landfill avoidance. Mm. And for the most of the recycle economy period, and we're at the end of that period now, we're in the dying days of the recycle economy, the driver was landfill avoidance.
So what drove that? Was it government legislation? Was it commercial governance? Was it? I know you've talked a bit about shareholder activism. What was actually driving the desire for, let's say, an owner of an office chair, or let's just put it in really simple terms, an owner of a piece of equipment to avoid that piece of furniture going into landfill? What was at stake for them to get that change happening?
Well, initially it was about the company culture, about whether they were prepared to see that happen or not. But nowadays, it's absolutely about shareholder activism. You can't be seen. You know, we work around all the universities in Australia, and if there's good furniture going into the skip simply because it can't be sold, then the students will complain about that. They're the shareholders of the university. The shareholders of companies don't buy companies that don't recycle properly, that don't have governance, that don't have social ESG, environmental social governance at board level, really. So it's gone from a nice to have because your shareholders will turn away and walk away from it.
Correct me if I'm wrong. We're talking sort of, I don't like to use the word tier, but we're talking tier one sort of company. We're talking sort of high profile companies, or we're seeing this across the board. How do you see that being played out?
I think you apply the 80-20 rule. Probably 20% of the large organisations in Australia control 80% of the procurement in the city and the floor plates in the city. And so really, that's the world we work in. That's probably why we're not necessarily known in the public realm, because we have a very small customer base that occupies a very large amount of the city. Mm. And they're the ones that are most sensitive to this what I call shareholder activism. It's a bit of a strong word for it, but it's roughly what's going on. They're protecting their reputation and as part of that process, then they recycle things.
Their response is to do the right thing because of that shareholder activism. So let's call it the consumer sentiment, shareholder, whatever you want to call it. It's actually having that impact on the economy, which to my mind is incredible and sort of demonstrates the importance of individuals, the role that individuals play in this world.
I think that's actually, we're now moved up right the way into 2020, 2021, because from 2010 onwards, really, it was the industry, the built environment industry, that was encouraging the customers to recycle, and they were sometimes taking it up and sometimes not. But now we get to 2023, and it's the large corporations that are demanding that the building industry gets its act together and increases its landfill avoidance, increases its recycle processes. and helps them move towards the circular economy, which is really, we're right on the cusp now of what I call a highly evolved recycle economy.
Mm-hmm.
We're at the dying days of that and moving into the circular economy.
Before we get into the circular economy, because I know we want to talk about that at some length, but I wonder if you wouldn't mind talking about just office space generally. Now, I know you're dealing with primarily the contents of offices, but also I suspect in your world, you would have seen what's happened to office spaces generally, and you would have seen the design of office spaces change and evolve. Now, since COVID, you know, it's hard to sort of get a sort of firm picture on what's actually happening in the CBD. So let's we're talking about Melbourne, but I suspect this is true of Sydney and other places. Essentially, we've gone from having fairly high levels of occupancy in the CBD, office spaces attracting good rents for building owners. Mm-hmm. COVID changed all of that. A whole lot of people moved away from the CBD and then started working from home. There's now been a desire to move people back into the CBD and into the city to kind of create that sort of active heart. And what I understand is that the occupancy rates, as we kind of have as reported, are probably not as high as they really are. But can you sort of give an overview as to what you've seen in terms of office spaces generally in the CBD?
I think pre-COVID, there was actually a move that probably has been dwarfed by COVID, which was called ABW, activity-based working, where it was much more broken up activity. So the desks were in line, side by side, straight, not corners. And there sometimes was only 75 desks for 100 staff.
Mm-hmm.
And then you'd have an area of meeting and breakout and an area of social. And so the office was broken up into the different activities that you were working on. That was well underway all the way through until COVID. And the city was organised itself that way. It had been through quite a significant shift. Probably took 15 or 20 years for that to transpire, and it was well and truly activity-based working. It was Office 101 in 2019, 2020. And then, of course, COVID hit and everybody went home. And I'm sort of not surprised that people didn't, for obvious reasons, when there was a pandemic, they didn't want to come and sit in a row of four desks where you're only less than a metre between you and the person sitting next to you. Yet for a long time, they've been doing that for a living, 40 hours a week. Mm. I don't know how.
Mm.
But I think people woke up to this is no good and I don't want to do it. And so the city is completely transferred since then. And I think there's some really interesting insights. One of the reasons why I love doing what I do is that I get to see the loading docks and I get to see the service lifts and I get to see the buildings when they're empty and when they're unoccupied, furnished. I get to see them at every stage. And seeing what I see in the city now, I think that there's a really obvious change coming. I could take any city, but if I take Melbourne,
mm-hmm.
if I take the streets of King Street, William Street and Queen Street and those kind of B and C grade buildings, old grey buildings, 80s and 90s,
mm-hmm.
maybe 15 stories high, dingy tiled entrance halls as you go in, two or three lifts, they're empty.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think anybody's going to go back and work in those.
Mm-hmm.
But if you go to the top end of the city, if you go up to where, you know, up to the where the premium grade buildings are, if you get a Cremorne or Richmond, what they call precinct offices, where people can live and people can work and people can have lunch and they can go, it's close to the sports precinct and the entertainment precinct. All around the world, the King Streets and Queen Streets are empty. And all around the world, the precincts are booming.
So the Cremornes, I mean, people who perhaps don't know Melbourne, Cremorne is actually a very small suburb, but it is thriving, as you rightly say. And it's kind of full of, you know, lighting shops, designers, architects, you know, and there's also, as you say, residences there. Mm-hmm. Really, you're quite right. I hadn't even really thought about that. But I know that it's incredibly difficult to find a park in Cremorne. But it's that activity that's actually really driving it, isn't it?
That's post-COVID. And you can see the difference. If you go a little bit further down the city of Melbourne, to the west, you end up at Docklands. And that doesn't quite know whether it's deserted or not just yet. But I suspect that it's not going to come back quite the same way. But, you know, Sydney's the same. You know, the inner western suburbs where there's working environments are booming. The city itself never really worked. The city of Sydney never really worked the same way as Melbourne did. It was never a precinct at night, never had quite had that same precinct. But the cities around the world are presenting the same way. I heard head of property at Dexus recently speaking, and they'd been to Chicago, and it's exactly the same thing.
So you're almost saying that these designated areas, which were, you know, central business districts, that's what CBD stands for, are failing. They're not surviving a post-pandemic world because they're sort of mono... functional, is that what you're saying?
I think it's slightly different to that. I think that it is closely related to occupancy rate. And when the occupancy is 95% of the floor plates, then everything is full. The opportunity that we've got now, the unpublished numbers are 60% occupancy, which gives this great opportunity to move everybody to the premium grade and do something about those C's and D's. And that, and so this, the process that we're seeing now in the city of Melbourne, Sydney and around the world is a 20-year journey.
Mm.
And it's a real opportunity for those parts of the city to regenerate.
Mm. And I assume what you're talking about is retrofitting some of those buildings to become premium grade buildings to attract people back into those precincts.
I mean, buildings are just like furniture. It's no longer acceptable now to demolish them and build a glitzy sky high. So, you know, in Melbourne recently, there was a very good example of it at 500 Bourke Street, where they retrofitted quite a substantial building rather than knock it down and rebuild it.
And it's also important to think of a building as not a blob in its own right. It's actually made up of component parts. It's got air conditioning, it's got carpets, it's got walls, it's got a glazing system, a facade system. So people think of it as a building as one object, but it's actually made up of many components, much like a piece of furniture. So it's very similar in many ways.
Yes, I think it goes one step beyond component, it goes to material. And that's what we're seeing right now, is this distinction between product and material.
So do you want to talk about that? Because I know this is really at the core of the circular economy, that every object that we think about is made up of material components.
Yeah, that's right. So it's a little bit of reverse thinking. If I talk about product over material, and I talk about the ability to extend the life of material, as I can do that, somewhere between 40 and 60% of the products that we see can be resold in either the retail or the wholesale markets as a product.
Mm-hmm.
But conversely, between 40 and 60% of those products can't be. So that's when it comes to a material level.
Just dwell on that for a moment. So let's say an office chair lands in your warehouse. You have an opportunity to sell that chair onto someone who has to be a custodian of that chair. They can't just say, okay, I'm buying that chair, but I'm sending it straight to the landfill. So there's a certain percentage of the office furniture that you have that can be unsold. And I've been to your warehouse and seen the sort of furniture that does get sold. Those pieces of furniture which can't get unsold can be stripped down for their material components and reused. That's essentially what you're saying.
So then the material gets reused, yes. And the material can be reused either as components in making up another piece of furniture, mm-hmm. whether it's contributing a desk becoming another desk,
mm-hmm.
or whether it's a piece of a desk becoming something else,
mm-hmm.
or it can be reused as aluminium and steel and plastic. In both occasions, it's what we call recovered resources.
Mm.
So we're getting to material level, and material is resource. And when you're dealing at circular economy level, you're dealing at material level.
Mm. So that aluminium would be either recycled and then become a different product, or the product itself, because of its material qualities, can be reused in a different piece of equipment.
At component level.
Component level. So the purpose of this whole way of thinking is to avoid any component ending up in landfill.
Any material ending up in landfill.
Mm.
By the time it gets to landfill, it's at material level.
Mm.
And the idea is that you can actually spend your time looking at what's in the waste bin and extracting as much material out of that as you can, finding ways to reuse it or to recycle it.
And just for the purposes of understanding, what can't we recycle? Like, I've been to your factory, I've been to your warehouse, and you've got bins there. And they're largely empty because you're trying to essentially extract every component that comes in for its material use. But there are bins there. So what would be an example of something that you just, at this point in time, you can't recycle?
So a good example is desk tops, and normally made out of melamine, which is the substrate, and then sitting on that as some laminate, which gives it some colour for the architects to decide what colour they want it to be, and then some edging. If the substrate is MDF, not melamine, then it's not recyclable. So that will end up in the bin. There may be seven different polymers of plastic. Some of those polymers are not recyclable. They will end up in the bin. Largely, though, what we see mostly in the bin is this problem called composite material, where they'll take a piece of material and then glue something on top of it and then upholster something on top of that. And sometimes either the process of breaking those composite materials apart is too expensive or it's not possible.
Mm-hmm.
Carpet tiles is a really good example of where it's not possible.
Mm-hmm.
And a seat pad for a chair is an example of where it's very expensive.
Mm-hmm.
But the idea is to keep on splitting this stuff up until you've got every piece of material out of it.
Mm-hmm.
And then that material is either recyclable or it's not. If it's not recyclable, that in the circular economy, that informs your procurement decisions. That material is the material that you don't buy. So if you're a large corporation, you would say to your furniture suppliers, I don't want any MDF to come in here, please. I don't want any polymer number 6 to come in here, please. I don't want you gluing foam on MDF board and upholstering that and putting a frame around that, side, please. Give me an eco panel screen.
I really want you to talk about the circular economy. And before we get into the nuts and bolts, can you define the circular economy? You've talked about the linear economy. You've talked about the recycle economy. Let's talk about what the circular economy, because it's certainly, you know, when I open up, you know, various platforms, it's the buzzword in architecture. Retrofitting and circular economy are kind of becoming the darlings of the design world. So you're in it. Let's talk about it.
Probably easier to tell you what it's not.
Yep.
The circular economy is not complicated.
Mm-hmm.
The circular economy is not the recycle economy. And the circular economy is not an end in itself. It's not a goal in itself. It's more of a guide. If you use the principles of the circular economy, the most well-known proponent is the Ellen MacArthur and the Ellen MacArthur Foundation. Their infographic is really simple. And if you follow what that says, it allows you to identify what you need to do to be circular. So it's almost a step-by-step process. Where it gets complicated in the academic world and out there in the world where you Google circular economy is people saying, well, it can't be circular because you're using energy to recycle that material. So it can't be circular. It is using. So the circular economy conversation is full of reasons why not, which is mostly put out by people who are protecting the current recycle economy. But really, at the end of the day, the circular economy is about not bringing anything into your environment that can't be salvaged at the end of its first use and recycled back up into the manufacturing. So it's just a world with no bin. I actually think that in the not too distant future, the circular economy conversation will slow down and it will become about more, it's more and more about recoverable resources and no landfill. That's the outcome.
So that will change procurement choices for architects who are going to, say, design an interior for Corporation X. They'll actually make material choices based on the ability of that material to be able to be recycled, not recycled, but to be repurposed for a different purpose.
That's right. So you remember, I noticed you stumbled there and it needs to be recycled. Actually, what you need to be able to do is put a whole bunch of systems and processes in place to allow you to use it for 14 or 21 years rather than 7 years. And after 21 years, then you can recycle it.
Why you say 7 years is because on average, an office interior is transformed after 7 years, more or less. A building has a life of more or less 50 years. It should be more like 100, but it's about 50 years before a major refurbishment or a major renovation occurs. So 7 years, what you're saying is, how do we get that to 21, 28 years?
Let's just bring that back a step, because I think this is really interesting, and this is what customers are starting to recognize, is that you've got a furniture cycle of 7 years and a building cycle of 50 years. Seven sevens are 49. They say that the contents of the building makes up about between 5 and 10% of the environmental impact of the building air. So if you change those contents seven times over the life of the building, it's over the life of the building, it's more like 50% of the environmental impact of the building is the contents. So you've got a much better chance of affecting the environmental outcome of something that turns over every 7 years in the furniture than you do out of doing anything with the building. You're fiddling at the edges with the building because it's already up. So what our customers who have got large property portfolios are realizing is that the FF&E, as you call it, I call it workstations and furniture, is low-hanging fruit. And they can direct the architects, the designers, the specifiers what they don't want, because otherwise it ends up in my bin. So don't bring that into my house, please.
Okay.
You could do this at home. But I'm talking about an office where the office owners are saying, the corporates are saying, don't bring that into my office.
And the reason why we're talking offices is because what I've seen is the scale of it is massive. So a corporation owns a large area of space.
Yeah, I mean, we learned to do this work that we're doing at universities. They've got 50,000 students, 10,000 staff, and 200 buildings. And what we liked about working there was that those buildings are what we call geographically co-located. So they're close together. So you can do an experiment there with furniture and get an outcome pretty quickly. But a large corporation, a large bank or an insurance company has exactly the same profile of property. It just happens to be some of it's in Melbourne, some of it's in Sydney, and some of it's in Adelaide. But now that we've got the systems and processes in place, that distance is less of an issue.
And we're talking about being able to procure furniture or being able to hold furniture for a period of time in your sort of custodianship and then shipping it back to that user when they need it.
That's right. So yeah, reuse is element number one. Reuse what you've got in the form that it's in without changing it. reuse it throughout your property portfolio.
Mm. Now, what's not happening? What's sort of something that you kind of need to see happen? Why is this not part of everyday conversation?
I think that at any level, government could regulate more. But I think more than what is not happening at the moment, I don't think there's been a moment like it. We're back into a demand cycle. And because we're right back full circle in this conversation, we talked about shareholder activism. The corporates have to do something, and they're being forced to do it because of the shareholder demand. And so the corporate is becoming the demand side of the equation, and the corporate is telling the building industry, actually, I don't want you to do that anymore. Actually, I'm going to interrogate what you're telling me. Actually, I'm going to really double check. I want you to bring me the dockets. I want you to prove your landfill avoidance. So they're really making high demands because they're being scrutinized. So there's never been a moment like it to actually make a big difference. And I think the next 24 to 36 months are going to be a massive shift.
So talk about designers. I mean, I know you don't deal necessarily directly with designers. You're kind of at a different end of the cycle. But what are you not seeing from architects and interior designers? When you see a modern new interior space, you must look at it and think, oh my God, you know, in 7 years that's going to have to do this. And that's, you know, you talked a bit about just before we started on air, an oval room with, you know, I would imagine furniture that suits that oval shape. But then you look at that furniture that's perhaps got a curved edge and a straight front or whatever. And you'd think, well, that's only ever going to work in this one particular space. What are you seeing from people like us that's not fit, you know, not where are we falling short in this whole equation?
I mean, it's a good question. I'll use a simple example. Multi-tenant building, maybe four floors, every floor upholstered in a different color. Level 10's green, level 11's yellow, level 12's purple, and level 13's blue. You know, you're consigning a lot of furniture to the reupholsterer or to the bin by doing that. Mm-hmm. That's a simple example of it. An 8-meter boardroom table with a one-piece top is consigned to the tip.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe you could make that out of some much more flexible conference furniture that you could collapse the tables and move them around and reuse them in different configurations.
So what's happening there? Do you think that the architect is being guided by the idea of design, prestige, the sort of idea of creating an iconic, you know, purposeful design? So they're not thinking about the recyclability or the reuse of those pieces of furniture? Are we being misled in some way as to what's actually important?
I don't think there's anything intrinsically wrong with what the industry's doing, but it's just an extension of what they've always done.
Mm-hmm.
We need a complete rethink. From the moment that something is specified. So think about it from my perspective, where we've got some really high quality material or some really high quality furniture that would suit the environment that the designer is designing for. The period of time between the design work and the fruition is 8 months, 12 months. Everything I've got then when they're designing is gone by then.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a process gap, which is too big.
Mm.
So what we're seeing more and more now is that the corporates are saying, actually, let's go and gather all the things that we think we can use and design that in.
Mm.
So buy first and design it in.
Mm.
Let's think about not having rounded edges on or oval tops. Let's think about the material, which is actually what the desk is actually a piece of melamine material. Let's cut it in a way that we can reuse it. Let's not share legs on workstations. So where you've got a bank of three workstations sitting alongside each other, let's have three sets of legs, not four legs for all three.
Mm. So the purpose being that you could change that around.
So then it becomes flexible. You can reuse it. If they don't want it anymore, we can resell it.
But are you finding, or can you see evidence? Let's assume you gathered different furniture from different components and there'd be a mix and match kind of style that would kind of emanate from that.
Mm.
You know, is that playing into a sense that it doesn't look as good as it should, or that somehow it's not as well designed as you would expect it to be for a corporate office? Or are people accepting that that's the price you pay and that's what we actually want, that's the aesthetic we want, and that's the outcome we want?
Well, I think it's a double-edged sword, isn't it? You know, sometimes there needs to be a compromise in the design, but sometimes the compromise in the design is what the stakeholders want to see.
Mm.
So, you know, the people that come to work are like-minded, you know, environmental activists who like the fact that the desks have been reused.
Mm.
It used to be the case that we would say, particularly to our university customers, we'll deliver the furniture like it's new. Nobody will know that it's not new.
Yeah, right.
And nowadays they're saying, we'd actually like them to know it's not new. Could you put a label on it so they know that?
So is university a fertile ground for you, I'm hearing?
Yeah, it's been a great learning space for us. You know, we learn with them together. We collaborate together across the tertiary sector. We've all learned a lot together, and it's a great environment to implement things. And then we can take that learning out into industry, into corporate.
So the outcome of all of this is really being able to reduce landfill. And we're talking about reducing landfill because ultimately that has a carbon transaction. Like the production of furniture in the first instance means that you have to expend carbon to kind of create the furniture. But also at the other end, there is this avoidance of landfill and carbon emissions. That's mm-hmm. that's really what we're mm-hmm. where the main game is mm-hmm. we're trying to move in this world of design mm-hmm. in this world of process and manufacturing mm-hmm. and we're trying to move to a decarbonized economy, because in essence the Australian government have legislated that we have to get to a 43% reduction by 2030, and we've made a commitment to net zero by 2050. And that time frame is incredibly short. I mean, 2030 is barely 6 years away. So I expect that the people that you're dealing with, the corporations, the universities, are guided to some extent by the university, or you know, the legislation's already there, but they're also really being driven that this is the way of the future and we have to actually be part of this whole new economy, which I suspect is a kind of global movement for change.
It is, and it's accelerating because of the demand. Mm. There's two sides to the question you're asking, or the proposition you're putting. The first one is landfill avoidance. In the absence of MDF instead of melamine, we're currently achieving 90 to 95% landfill avoidance. We'll get to 98, 99% landfill avoidance. So landfill avoidance is accelerating and more mature than carbon capture and carbon reduction. So landfill avoidance, well, landfill itself, we're crossing out the word landfill now, we're talking about resource recovery. So we can recover 95% of the resources in the environment that we work. The question then is about, so how much carbon is embedded in the material that these things are made out of? Mm. And the next phase, which is starting now, is to identify, well, okay, so in a these are crazy numbers, but it's roughly the way it works. In a ton of aluminium, there's 22 ton of carbon embedded. In a ton of steel, there's 5 ton of carbon embedded. There's a material difference between the two, yeah? So more and more when you start to talk carbon, you're designing material out, mm. swapping that material around. Obviously, there's energy used to produce the material, mm. and there'll be a whole academic argument about, well, you know, so the circular economies will never work because you're going to burn fuel to get... But the bottom line is that you can practically, measurably reduce the carbon in your property portfolio by considering the materials that you allow in there. That's an indisputable fact. You can, carbon reduction is no different than landfill reduction. Mm. And whilst carbon reduction is slightly behind it, maybe 5 or 7 years behind it, it will follow the same trajectory. And as the world learns how to produce energy in a more renewable way, then the materials that we are making will produce less carbon. Less carbon will be used to produce it. So, if, you know, I don't think that circular economy is an exacting science and going to get us to zero. Mm. Net zero, I have my doubts about net zero. I don't think it's going to get us to real zero. But it's, as far as I can see, it's the best roadmap. Mm. And it'll get us a fair way down the track. By the time we get down there, there'll be smarter people than me have worked out how to finish off the job.
Mm. So one last question. This podcast is essentially designed for, or thought of as, I guess, you know, something to offer young people who are entering into the design field, whether it's architecture or urban design or landscape, or whether they're planning on becoming a chef or whatever. What advice would you give to a young person entering into whatever field they're going into, and if their interest is in design and sustainability, what would you be saying to a younger version of yourself in terms of what the next 4, 5, 10 years offers?
I would be encouraging them to look outside the industry. I think the industry has some blinkers on. I see it from the demand side, where the demand side, the corporates are demanding that the industry takes the blinkers off, and some people are taking that on in the right frame of mind and are working with the corporates, and they're the ones that are getting the work and they're the ones that are making a difference. And there are some that are still thinking, well, actually, I just want to sit at my desk and I want to specify fabulous colours and the best European this and the best European that, which probably the corporates are thinking, I'm not sure. I totally get it from an aesthetic perspective. I don't think you have to crash aesthetic to get the right outcome at the other end, but I think you need to be really designing with the outcome in mind, and the outcome is carbon reduction and zero landfill.
Mm. What a really good way to end the conversation. I really, really appreciated today's conversation. I really learned a lot. I guess that's really why I do these podcasts, because I get to learn. But really, really want to say thank you, Andrew, for coming on. I know you're busy and I know you took time out of your day to sort of be part of this podcast. So thank you very much.
It's great. It's been a privilege to join you in the conversation. I really like what you're doing with your podcast and I'm more than happy to contribute. Thank you.
Okay. Well, thank you very much and see you for the next podcast.
Thanks.